Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies, part of the New Books Network of Podcasts. I am Moran Badenson and I am the host of this channel. With us today is Professor Alexander Prasin of New Mexico Tech, who studies the history of World War II in Eastern Central Europe and the Balkans. In his recently published book, he delineates the Nazi occupation of Yugoslavia during World War II. He starts from the medium-term background, reaching back to the unification of Yugoslavia, and covers both the chronological process of the occupation to the liberation, and its wide thematic breadth, with issues ranging from Jews and non-Jews in the camps, collaborationism, Jew resistance, and different strands of resistance in Yugoslavia. And this makes the book important not only for historians of Yugoslavia, South Eastern Europe, or the Balkans, but also to historians of World War II and the Holocaust more generally. First of all, it's very nice to have you here with us today, Professor Prasin. The first question I would have for you is, why did you choose to study Serbia under the Nazi rule?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for having me here. I was focusing on Yugoslavia in wartime because the war in Yugoslavia was unique in many ways, not only there was a war going on, kind of a conventional war against the oppressors or the Nazis but and the Italians, but also there was a sort of a multi-faceted war, civil war, going on sometimes between two, three, or four opponents. So it was, in this case, Yugoslavia was a rather a unique case among the histories who suffered German occupation during World War II. And Serbia, surprisingly, has received least attention from the Western scholarship, most likely because the resistance movement, which started in the summer 1941, then petered out, so to speak, by the winter of 1941-42, because the gravity of that resistance warfare moved elsewhere in Yugoslavia to Bosnia, Herzegovina, and so on. And Serbia, kind of from late 1941 on, was left out by the Western scholarship. So it was my first interest, which brought me to that topic. And the other one was that I don't remember the exact dates. It is within the last probably 7 or 8 years the Serbian government decided to rehabilitate some of the individuals who actively participated in the Nazi occupation structure. I'm talking about native collaborators. This is not, again, something unique for Serbia. It's going on all over Eastern Europe. And I was determined to seek the truth, so to speak, whether these individuals indeed perhaps were vilified under communist rule and needed indeed some sort of a post-mortem rehabilitation. So those were two main reasons which brought me to study, research first, and then write on Serbia. In addition, this is kind of a less important note, but Serbia has had a long history, tradition of resistance to foreign rule, and I wanted to see the dynamics of that resistance, whether it was comparable to anything that the Serbia had experienced before, let's say, under the Austro-Hungarian and Bulgarian occupations in World War I. So those would be my primary reasons of concentrating on Serbia.
Now, you did mention some reasons why the Serbian or the Yugoslav case was different, and we do know that in the history of occupied Europe, we have various models, if one can say so, of Nazi rule. We had the harsher rule in Poland, we had more lenient rule over the Nordic countries, and we also know that these models of rule were motivated not only by ideological terms like Drang nach Osten, Lebensraum, and Neuordnung, but also by some practical matters. What was the Nazi model of ruling Serbia, and how is it motivated by both reality and Nazi ideology?
In general, Nazi plans for Yugoslavia were driven, as you said, by initially by expediency rather than ideology. Hitler was rushing to implement his Barbarossa plan, that is the invasion of the Soviet Union. He didn't need this, what he called it, the destruction in the Balkans. And if Yugoslavia remained within the orbit of Nazi Germany after signing the pact with Germany in March 1941, and if it stuck to that pact, perhaps German occupation would have been, or rather domination of Yugoslavia could have been similar to that to the situation in Bulgaria, which retained a relatively free hand in dealing with its internal affairs. But it so happened that a few days after signing that tripartite pact, the Yugoslavian political elite decided to go against it, against the grain, so to speak, and they overthrew the current government in Belgrade, although without any intention whatsoever to antagonize Hitler, but Hitler's reaction were quite harsh. And so from getting from this idea of just having Yugoslavia as an economic and administrative unit in his Balkan plans, he decided to punish it. And the punishment was swift and harsh. Yugoslavia was defeated, dismembered. And because Hitler thought of the Serbian political elite as behind that plot, officer's plot in Belgrade, he envisioned for Serbia particularly harsh conditions, meaning it was deprived of any sort of vestiges of independence and was placed under military rule. Again, German generals who came to control Serbia, that is the heads of the administration, initially were inclined to treat Serbia simply as an economic and administrative unit. If there were no resistance, probably, here we are getting into a field of probabilities, probably Serbia would not have suffered as much as it would. But it so happened that in the summer 1941, there was an outbreak of resistance, communist resistance, and Chetnik, that is nationalist resistance. And from that time on, the rule of expediency, or rather the concept of expediency, turned into an ideological concept of eliminating the communist movement, and since the communists were associated in the Nazi minds, in Nazi mentalities with Jews, it was also expedited the process of mass murder of Serbia's Jews.
You mentioned before resistance. Now, we know that hand in hand with resistance goes collaboration in Europe, and we have seen various models like the Ustasha in Croatia and the infamous Jasenovac camp system. We saw collaboration by gendarmerie and military unity in Romania. We saw, obviously, in Galicia and in the Ukraine. How did collaboration look like, or what were the relationship, what was the relation between the Nazi authority or Nazi-inspired authorities and the local population in Serbia?
Well, Serbia, again, here played a major role in the Nazi occupation system in the Balkans, because Serbia before the war was the core area of of Yugoslav politics. After all, the government was in Belgrade. But after the war, the April War, and the outbreak of resistance, there were some changes within the within the, as I said, the views, Nazi views in regards to Serbia. So speaking of the local administration, naturally in any country that the German army had conquered, they established some sort of a native administration that was a rule of expediency. The Germans did not have enough manpower, and it was expedient certainly for them to seek individuals and groups who would be willing to collaborate. So in Serbia, they were, if you will, found themselves in a sort of a ideological conundrum, because individuals who would be the most suitable candidates, those who shared with the Nazis their ideological views, were very few and far between. The Serbian fascist or quasi-fascist, if you will, the so-called Zbor movement, was very small, very marginal before the war, and it had no popular or very small popular support. So the Germans probably could have chosen somebody like Zbor's leader, Dmitri Ljotić, but as I said, he was he realized himself that he had no popular backing. So, and therefore, the Nazis decided to back those circles, which could be in our modern language probably classified as centrist rightist, with the centrist rightist affiliations, individuals who had some who held some positions in the pre-war Yugoslav government, certainly no lovers of communists. There were individuals known for anti-communist proclivities, but they had, as I said, the Nazis had in Serbia not too many choices. And so the first government, which they created immediately after the April War, the so-called Council of Commissars, was a kind of a mishmash of individuals with clear pro-Nazi proclivities, as well as those who were rather disinclined to share Nazi views. Individuals, as I said, of centers, center-rightist political affiliations. But that government existed, or administration rather, existed until August, when the Germans decided to replace it with a much more, not necessarily loyal, because the commissars were loyal enough, but perhaps more effective sort of administration. And they chose a Serbian general, a veteran of several of the Balkan Wars, and a veteran of World War One, General Milan Nedic, who was clearly of anti-communist disposition, although it is questionable whether he felt any affinity, at least in the beginning, to Nazi political views. So these individuals, sometimes they willingly accepted the positions within the collaborationist administration. Sometimes they were chosen, pressed perhaps. Milan Nedic's apologists after the war argued that he was pressed into that position as the head of the local administration. Or some of them, and I include Milan Nedic here too, thought that it was the best choice for the Serbian people to save them from more terror and more oppression. And when I say terror and oppression, in their view, it was less German terror, but perhaps more the communist revolution. And so the local administration then called upon back to service Serbian functionaries, civil servants, policemen, gendarmes, and they build up a relatively substantial collaborationist apparatus, which did the biddings of their German masters. And here the collaboration, as you know, the issue of collaboration is always controversial because there are many questions whether these individuals, as I mentioned before, acted under duress. Some of them now, especially nowadays in Serbia, Milan Nedic is some circles in Serbia. I'm not saying that the official the government of Serbia, but at least some very vocal groups in Serbia claim that Milan Nedic was a savior of Serbia from more bloodshed, and therefore there is even a book issued, published relatively recently, which includes Milan Nedic into 100 of the most famous Serbs in history. So here is, as I said, collaboration is always kind of a double-edged sword in terms of the causes of collaboration, the dynamics of collaborations, and of course the participation of local collaborationists in the Nazi terror system, which they did eventually in Serbia and took rather an active part.
When you study East Central Europe, the discourse of on and the, let's say that the scholarly attention to the phenomenon of collaboration is much more pronounced, at least in my feeling, than in the historiography about the Holocaust and World War II in general in Serbia. Do you find any difference in either collaboration or in speaking about collaboration between the Balkans and East Central Europe, Ukraine, Ukraine, Poland, etc.?
Well, in my opinion, and I expressed it, I hope I expressed it clearly in my book on Serbia, if we're talking about collaboration in general, we cannot avoid but talk about participation in the Holocaust, because collaboration in any country in Europe, it was a key element of collaboration, was the persecution of Jews or treatment of Jews. So in Central Europe, the situation in that regard, the situation was different because long, very long traditions of living side by side, and that is Jews and their neighbors, Poles, Ukrainians, and Russians on one hand, and long traditions, very long traditions of anti-Semitism. And all of that, you know, those two aspects conflated during the war, producing in very many places rather a murderous environment and propitious environment for the Holocaust, for the local participation in the Holocaust. Take the Baltics, for example, or Ukraine. And parts of Russia, although nowadays in Russia they're saying, you know, it was on a lesser extent than elsewhere. In Yugoslavia in general and in Serbia and in particular, these issues were much less pronounced. I'm not saying that there was no anti-Semitism. Of course, it was. But traditionally, because of Ottoman rule, because of the Austro-Hungarian presence, these antagonisms, in my opinion, I'm not saying it is as it was, but in my opinion, were much less pronounced. That is, there were some anti-Semites among Serbs, certainly. But if you take the statistics of survival in Serbia, and very few Jews actually survived in Serbia, not due to local participation, in contrast to Ukraine, the Baltics, and Poland, where local participation actually contributed to almost the totality of the Holocaust. In Serbia, because of this long traditions of relative, I should emphasize, a relative tranquility between the Serbs and Jews, those Jews who had escaped from the ghettos in Serbia and from the hands of the Nazis, and mostly they found refuge among Serbs. And some of those Serbs, of course, they were friends before the war, but some were totally unknown strangers. And this is something that I would place on the level of comparison with Poland and Ukraine. If a Jewish family escaped from, let's say, Kyiv to the countryside of the Kyiv province, I would doubt its chances of survival. I'm not saying that all Ukrainians were anti-Semites, but as I said, traditions of anti-Semitism and German policies in Ukraine contributed to a very high level of participation in the Holocaust. In Serbia, some Jews who, as I said, found refuge among Serbs who were not their friends or relatives had a relatively high chance of survival. In addition, there were the Serbian intellectual elite before the war did not display the same sort of anti-Jewish sentiments in comparison to, let's say, their Polish counterpart. Some Serbian intellectuals were rather, if you will, fond of comparing Serbia's history and Jewish history. Some Serbian intellectuals pointed out that, you know, Serbia was a sort of an Israel, if you will, in the Balkans because it had been conquered and oppressed for such a long time, like Jews, and nevertheless they survived similarly to Jews. So these sentiments, whether they played a major role in the treatment of Jews during the war by the local population is of course questionable, but nevertheless, as I said, judging by the statistics of those Jews who had escaped from the ghettos and camps and hid among Serbs, the survival rate was higher in proportion-wise, higher than elsewhere in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Romania, Poland, and Ukraine. And therefore, it is my personal opinion that the chances of survival in Serbia for the Jews were higher than elsewhere.
Speaking about Jews, you have dedicated a whole chapter in your book to discuss Serbia as Serbs and Jews, and in Serbia and Yugoslavia in general, World War II, much like the Yugoslav wars of the 90s, are actually a few conflicts coalesced together. So what was the role or the relative role, the relative size of the Holocaust within World War II in the Balkans, perhaps compared to regions like the Soviet Union or East Central Europe?
Well, we have to start here from the numbers, right? From the pure statistics. Of course, as far as I remember, there were about 80, perhaps 90,000 Jews altogether in the Yugoslav state before the war. So on one hand, it made the Nazi goal of physical elimination much easier. On the other hand, the relatively small numbers, again, coming back to the previous question, contributed to a relative tranquility between the Yugoslav people and Jews, because Jews were not as pronounced, for example, in trade or commerce as they were in Poland, where the competition between Jewish and non-Jewish men of business, men of commerce, that competition sometimes got very vicious. That's why, again, contributing in future years to the local participation in the Holocaust. Jews here in Yugoslavia and in Serbia, for example, were a very small minority. We're talking about in Serbia between 12 to 15,000 people in the country of about 3 million people. And they were not as visible in politics as they were, for example, in Poland. This kind of invisibility in many ways contributed to, as I said, less pronounced collaboration in the native collaboration in the Holocaust as it was elsewhere in East Central Europe. The traditional stigma of Judeo communa, where Jewish participation and dominance in the communist movement was also less applicable in Yugoslavia, because there were Jews within the Communist Party, but again, not in the same proportions that they were, let's say, in Poland, or at least in the eyes of those who were negatively disposed towards Jews. Naturally, the after the collapse of Yugoslavia, the collaborationist government in Croatia made a big deal of it, and the Serbian administration, the collaborationist administration in Serbia, also made focus or emphasis on the Jewish alleged control of the communist movement. But in reality, again, for perhaps for an average Serbian, that was not necessarily the case. Again, as a one factor, at least, in mitigating somewhat anti-Jewish sentiments. I don't want to say that you know, that there was no persecution of Jews by the local administration. Of course, there was, and the gendarmerie in Serbia participated in rounding up, registering and rounding up Jews and escorting them to the ghettos. There was a special unit created by the Serbian collaborationist administration called the Special Police, which whose primary task was to combat the communist resistance, but in their views, Jews and communists were the same, so they actively participated in hunting down Jews. And of course, there were some locals who benefited from denouncing Jews to either to the Germans or to the native police. But as I said, by and large, if you know, under closer scrutiny, you will find very astonishing, some at least, very astonishing cases when Serbian politicians known for having no love for Jews before the war actually tried to save them. We have some policemen participating in the efforts to save Jews, as well as the Chetniks. The Chetnik case is particularly least studied. For that matter, I found very difficult to find any documentation in regards to the Chetnik treatment of the Jews. And nevertheless, we do know some of some cases where Jews who escaped from the Germans lived in the areas controlled by the Chetniks, and most likely that the villagers, as well as the local Chetnik commanders, knew of them, and nevertheless, they survived the war. So this is a very, as anywhere, it is a very kind of a Jewish, non-Jewish relationship is a very complicated issue, which still has many holes and many gaps, which in the future, I hope, could be somehow filled.
When we speak about resistance, we see that many of the things you said about, for example, collaboration are things that began before the Nazi invasion and were some sort of internal processes within the first Yugoslavia and were only exacerbated by the Nazi invasion. For example, you mentioned quite a lot of time the equation of Jews and communists and in general the debate, less intellectual than you might expect, but also in intellectual circles about whether communism is really the path we should be heading. And I would like to ask you not only about resistance movements in general, but also their ideological stances. Because after all, the royal couple of the second Yugoslavia, Josip Broz Tito and Jovanka, both were from the partisans, and in Tito's case, he emerged as a winner from the resistance, but began his political activity and communist activity much before that. So what are the ideological origins or ideological stances that motivated the different strands of resistance in Serbia and Yugoslavia?
Well, you mentioned the Communist Party and Josip Broz Tito. Of course, he was the key figure in the resistance movement during the war. Yugoslav Communist Party was a very small group, similarly to some other communist parties which sprang up in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution. I think it was no more than like 8,000 or 10,000 people in the 1920s. Their ideological framework was identical to their predecessors. I'm talking about the Russian Bolsheviks. But in regards to the Jewish question, why communism was so attractive to Jews, because no other political movement or no other political ideology, and I'm talking here no ideology outside of socialism and communism, offered them civil and political equalities. No other ideology emphasized that there would be no difference between people of different religions, people of different languages, backgrounds, ethnicities, and so on, in the state which the communist aimed to build. So it was quite natural that for an oppressed minority, here I'm referring to the Jewish minorities everywhere, not only in Yugoslavia, not only in Eastern Europe, but everywhere in Europe in general, in France or in Italy, where the communist parties were quite substantial. So in my opinion, it was quite obvious for the Jews, if they wanted to survive, if you will, to join a resistance movement, which started in 1941. There was only way to join the partisans, because there were not only there were Jews within the leadership of the partisan movement, but there were many survivors who escaped from the ghettos and the camps, and they were treated relatively well, that is, relatively depending upon local conditions. But I do not recall any case where, for example, the partisans would kill a Jewish SKP, which, by the way, was quite frequent. Let's say in Poland or Ukraine, where the anti-German partisans, not necessarily of communist affiliation, would kill Jewish families who were hiding from the Nazis. So here, as I said, the ideological framework of the communist movement was for the Jews was quite clear and quite attractive. That is why so many of them joined the communist movement. In regards to the civil war in Yugoslavia and in Serbia during the Nazi occupation, indeed, as you mentioned, the foundation for that, the roots of the civil war were quite visible in the interwar period, because the communists very clearly identified their political goals, the destruction of the old Yugoslav, the bourgeois Yugoslav state. So that very pronounced, if you will, objective made very many Yugoslavs quite uncomfortable of the communists, and therefore the Chetnik movement, for one, initially cooperated with the partisans, but then when they realized that their goals were totally opposite, we have yet another series of a conflict, internal conflict, that is the Chetniks and the partisans turning upon each other. So Jews participating in the communist movement on one hand before the war, and joining the resistance movement because it offered them the only chance to survival. For me, it was, as I said, quite a clear, if you will, and the only choice.
In today's Serbia, we have multiple minorities who claim to have undergone a Holocaust. Today, we don't have a vocal Jewish minority, but we can speak about the Romas, for example, with representatives such as Rajko Djuric, who is a leading Serbian-Romanian writer and academic, who wrote a poem not so long ago called Ja sam Yad Vashem, I am Yad Vashem, in alluding, of course, to the famous museum and research center in Israel. Do you think that when we speak about Holocaust in Serbia, do you think that we speak enough about the people in these camps, whether Ustasha camps or Nazi camps, that are not Jews?
Do we speak enough of them? That was your question?
Do we speak enough of them, or let's say, what was their place in this concentration / extermination process?
Well, with the exception of Sajmište, which was perhaps the most infamous camp in Serbia, there were smaller camps, naturally, in Serbia, where Jews very often shared tragic fate with non-Jews. For example, there were camps where they were kept together before executions with Serbian communists or individuals who were suspected of some sort of anti-Nazi activities. Some Chetniks, for example, were incarcerated alongside Jews, communists, and the Roma, but also thousands of just average Serbs who were caught in those roundups and German reprisals shared the fate of Jews, because when in the late summer, early fall 1941, the Germans instituted a harsh reprisal policy by which for every killed German soldier, there were 50 to 100 civilians killed. And although the Jews were first to die, very soon the Germans ran out, so to speak, of the Jewish quarter, and they turned to Serbian civilians. And here they made no distinctions whatsoever in regards to who these individuals were. For example, in Kragujevac, they were shooting individuals who even were kind of positively inclined towards the collaborationist administration. There were some individuals even who worked for the local administration, but for the Nazis, it made no difference whatsoever. So here we are talking an issue which has been a topic of discussion, I think, for at least two decades. That is, what part the Holocaust plays in the general history of a given country, any country in Europe, and to what extent can we compare the fate of the Jews and the fate of their non-Jewish co-nationals? That is, to what extent the history of Yugoslavia is a history of Jewish suffering, or vice versa, to what extent Jewish suffering is a part of the history of Yugoslavia? This is a very difficult question, and I think that it will be some years before we would be able to answer that question in a kind of a more substantial way. But local sympathies that I talked about, local sympathies toward Jews among the average Serbian, some average Serbian co-nationals, in part, in my opinion, was generated by that perception of common tragic fate. And that fate, as I said, which had a long history before the war, the foreign oppression, the expulsions, forced migrations, and so on and so on. And that sympathy sometimes displayed by Serbian civilians toward Jews partially was generated by that perception of common tragic fate that, first Jews and then us, and indeed the Germans, as I mentioned, showed no inclination to kind of mitigate reprisals against the Serbs, because by the fall of 1941, many German generals in Serbia, and Hitler himself, considered Serbs to be the most vicious enemy of the Third Reich in the Balkans. I want to emphasize Serbs, speaking ethnically, in comparison to the Bulgarians, Romanians, or the Croats, who lived by this time under the vicious pro-Nazi government in the so-called independent Croatia. Having said that, I want to qualify that many Croats, of course, despised the Ustasha, but they just at that time had no choice. But in more common average, if you will, perception in Serbia, it probably was a very strong factor that Jewish SKPs coming at night, knocking on a door at the Serbian house, were perceived simply as individuals who needed a refuge, who needed help, and not necessarily those Serbs who turn out to be good Samaritans. Not necessarily they saw them as Jews per se. They saw them just as their Serbian co-nationals, regardless of their Jewish religion or Jewish roots.
When we speak about World War II in general, and let's say when we speak about World War II in the Soviet Union, contemporary Russian Federation, we often speak about the role the war played in constructing national identities or the influence of the war on intellectual trends today. And in the Russian case, at least, we see that, for example, children of young age can still find themselves singing the wartime hits or even sometimes post-war songs like Katyusha, Sinje Platojček, and other very famous songs. What do you feel that is the, where do you think that we can find the traces of the war in Yugoslav and contemporary Serbian identity and reality?
Well, frankly speaking, I have not, when I was doing my research in Serbia, I concentrated so much on seeking, you know, documentation that I had very little time to just to speak with, you know, Serbs of different age and affiliations. But I talked to my landlord. I lived in a very nice place in Belgrade. And he then introduced me to some of his neighbors. The common perception, and that I know actually even from living in the Soviet Union, because when I live in the Soviet Union, I met a few people from Yugoslavia then in the 1980s. And so the Serbs quite naturally perceived themselves as the leading force in the resistance movement, because they were indeed the leading initially. They were a majority, I'm talking about the ethnic majority, because they were persecuted not only by the Germans, but in Bosnia-Herzegovina, they became very soon under a terror attack of the Ustasha. And so the Serbs joined the resistance movements, and here I want to emphasize in plural, both the communists and the Chetniks, because it was the way for many, the only way to survive. And quite naturally, after the war was over, the Serbs, many Serbs at least, claim the primacy in leading the communist movement. And in this regard, they were helped by the official establishment, which did not necessarily emphasize the role of the Serbs, but emphasized the role of the Yugoslavs in general, presenting the conflict, the war in the Balkans as sort of a, if you will, the third front. And enough to watch the so-called partisan films made in Yugoslavia, which were very popular in the Soviet Union, because it was a totally kind of unknown page for many Soviet people. And if you look at those films, if you watch those films, you will very clearly sense the kind of the main idea where the Germans are sending division after division into the Balkans. And these divisions are engulfed in a very hard fighting. And the partisans, no matter what, they survive. So long before the Americans and the British opened up the second front, there was a third front. In the Balkans. And as I said, that partisan mythology, if you will, has persevered up until this very time. When I was in Belgrade, I was the last time I was there, I think it was 2010. There was kind of a renewed interest in the resistance movement, although the Chetniks now have become kind of also a key element in that mythology. But very clearly, and especially as you said, on the background of the recent wars in Yugoslavia, that the image of the Yugoslav guerrilla, regardless of political affiliation, is very popular in Yugoslavia. And when I was a kid, I was watching those films with great interest. And when I became a mature adult, I watched them with greater interest still, because at that time I could look at those films from kind of many different angles.
My last question would still be in the realm of memory, but in a different angle. You're a historian who has studied so far two main arenas of World War II and the Holocaust. The first one, East Central Europe, Ukraine, Poland. The second one, Serbia and Yugoslavia. As a historian who reads critically through the historiography, in what do you feel that there is the biggest difference between scholarly attention paid to World War II in Yugoslavia and the scholarly attention directed to World War II in East Central Europe?
You know, this is a question which kind of is difficult for me to answer, because I just a month ago, I was at a conference. It was not even a conference, it was sort of a workshop where we presented, where authors presented their books to the academic community as well as the general public, new books. And a colleague of mine, Professor Gabriel Finder, and I, we published a book on the war crimes trials of the Nazis in communist Poland. And it has nothing to do with Yugoslavia, but it has something to do with your question in terms of the scholarship and the perception of or images of World War II in Yugoslavia and Poland. I've been to many conferences, to a number of conferences on Yugoslavia, where I talked about my Serbian case. I have not faced in those conferences any sort of kind of a resistance or denial to what I said. Some of my colleagues in Serbia, they question my conclusions and actually help me formulate my ideas better. But the presentation of the book on Poland in Warsaw a month ago, when we were talking about our books, our vis-a-vis, that is our reviewers, and they all were from Poland, at some points, they were very negative about our findings and our conclusions. So here, when we talked about the kind of a post-war atmosphere in Poland and anti-Jewish sentiments and anti-Jewish violence, there was a very pronounced, in my opinion, I'm afraid of the word resistance, but what would be a better word? Reluctance to accept what we said. And as I said, I've been to several conferences on Serbia and Yugoslavia. And sometimes, for example, at Yad Vashem, I was there twice, there were individuals from Yugoslavia, from the former Yugoslavia at least. There was a gentleman who was an Orthodox priest, I remember, and I never faced that in those settings. As I said, they may have corrected me on some episodes or names or dates. They may have questioned my conclusions, but there was no kind of a vehemence in response in regards to my conclusions. Once, as I said, in Poland, or in Lviv, or in Kiev, there would be always a group which would come to a point where their reluctance to accept my ideas would be bordering upon total rejection. So here, I'm kind of leading you astray from your question, but this is, in my opinion, this is the biggest difference between not necessarily Western scholarship, although there were some scholars in those discussions, as I said, in Warsaw, there were three scholars, quite respectable. In my opinion, maybe I was lucky in terms of speaking on Yugoslavia. I never kind of encountered that. And so in my opinion, I feel now as a researcher, as a scholar, more comfortable speaking to some sort of a Yugoslav academic community than to Polish or Ukrainian.
Thank you very much for this very interesting conversation. I have no further questions, but the traditional ending question is there anything that you feel like we need to know about Serbia's World War II that I forgot to ask?
Well, you caught me by surprise. Naturally, there are some gaps to fill. I'm sure I cannot just none come to comes to mind nowadays, but at this point. But the history of Yugoslavia, in my opinion, is still an open field. It may sound very strange, given the fact that there are thousands of books written on Yugoslavia. But in my opinion, there are still some fields to pursue. For example, a colleague of mine called me a regional historian, emphasizing my interest to small regions. For example, the histories, if we're talking about the period of World War II, the histories of Macedonia, Kosovo, Montenegro, all of them expect, actually, await their own researchers. Perhaps there is more research done on Croatia. But even Serbia itself, Banat, Vojvodina, those parts of Yugoslavia, as I said, are still, in my opinion, are still very much open fields for any researchers willing to do it, because this is not a very pleasant topic, but a very interesting one. For that matter, when I was in Belgrade, I've heard from my colleagues, from my Serbian colleagues, that is academic colleagues, that they wish that some Western researchers actually express interest to do something like that, given that the archives are open and Yugoslavs are very friendly people, I can assure that, regardless whether they Serbs, Croats, or Montenegrins. That is indeed something for some young, aspiring scholar to think about.
Okay, thank you very much. This was a very interesting conversation about a very interesting, not to say neglected, region in our understanding of World War II, especially in this kind of synthesis textbooks that offer, a broad grasp of the war. So I'd like to thank you again for interviewing to our channel, New Books in Eastern European Studies.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So thank you, and see you in the next episode of New Books in Eastern European Studies.